And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Steve Weinberg, is the author of To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science. Weinberg is an American theoretical physicist and Nobel laureate in physics for his contributions in with two other gentlemen on the unification of the weak force and the electromagnetic interaction between elementary particles. I don't think I understand that, Lynn. He's written a book on the evolution of modern science.
And I just have to say that comes from notes that he taught a course on the history of modern science to non-science majors. So if that intro sounded heavy, it's not so heavy. Good morning, John. Our second guest this morning is Michael Tennyson. He's the author of the book, The Next Species, The Future of Evolution and the Aftermath of Man. While examining the history of our planet and actively exploring our present environment, science journalist Tennyson describes what life on Earth could look like after the next mass extinction. A growing number of scientists agree that we're headed towards a mass extinction, the sixth one, perhaps in as little as 300 years. There have already been five mass extinctions in the last 600 million years. Are we due for another? These two guests, plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
And good morning. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. We're going to change things up a little bit, and we are going to go and do today's cool story first. So we're going to do that for you now. As you probably know, Lynn and I are real STEM fans, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics in education. And we have this to report. Recipients of the Governor's Medal for Science and Technology were announced this week in Salt Lake. The Governor's Medal for Science and Technology is Utah's highest honor in STEM science, which is, again, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. They include seven individuals and one company.
That's right. And one of those is USTAR, and we've spoken to them several times on this program, the Governor's Office of Economic Development and the Utah Science, Technology, and Research, USTAR, initiative collaborate on the yearly awards. Dr. Ivy Estabrook is the executive director of USTAR. She says the recipients are nominated by their peers from around the state.
Four of the honorees are from the University of Utah. Dr. Phyllis Coley and Dr. Eric Jorgensen are the university's biology department, and also receiving the medal are Dr. Ronald Weiss, who's the president and COO of ARUP Laboratories, and Trey D'Ambrosio, who's the executive director of the Lassonde Entrepreneur Institute at the David Eccles School of Business.
And also some recipients from a high school, from Juan Diego Catholic High School in Salt Lake. It's Dr. Christine Celestino, in addition to a professor of computer science at Westminster. That's Dr. Helen Hugh. Neil Holt, who is the director of Utah State University's Space Dynamics Laboratory, and they're doing great things up there. He was one of the recipients, as well as one company, Orem-based U.S. Synthetic. They are the largest producer of diamond cutters in the world. Isn't that interesting?
Fascinating.
Yeah, so that Governor's Medal for Science for STEM has been awarded annually since 1987. And we have a lot of great science going on in this state, as we have really learned here on this show, between University of Utah, amazing in bioengineering and all kinds of engineering and science there, as well
Spider
as Utah.
Silk.
Yeah, that's right. Utah State University.
You know what's interesting is that Boston, for an example, has this reputation of being a place that has these great education, these great pillars, you know, Harvard and MIT and Tufts and BU and BC and all that. But Utah seems to, and Utah does as well, but Utah is more of a secret. You know, I don't think people outside of Utah really appreciate how strong the University of Utah, Utah State University, Brigham Young University is in these STEM subjects. I mean, mm-hmm. really, really strong.
I think a lot of us who live in the state don't realize it either. And they're excellent universities. So, you know, some good options that our kids have when they grow up. And
certainly
of course,
do. They
all want to leave the state, right?
Right. So,
some good opportunities for those from outside the state to come here, ski, and attend a great university. There we go. Well, we're going to take another quick break for underwriters. And when we return, we will be back with our first guest, Steven Weinberg. He's the author of the book, To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science. Very interesting. He's a Nobel Prize winner from 1972, I believe, in particle physics. And we're looking forward to that conversation. And we will be right back.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We have been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976 and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information can be found at bhhsutah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Nexus IT is proud to support Cool Science Radio and KPCW. Nexus IT provides complete cloud computing solutions to streamline and simplify your business, IT processes, and logistics. 435-487-9099. NexusITC.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning is Steve Weinberg, who's the author of To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science. Steve has written a fascinating book on the history of science from the Greeks to modern times. He shows that scientists of ancient and medieval times not only did not understand what we understand about the world, but they didn't understand what there is to understand or how to understand it. Yet, over the centuries, through the struggle to solve the many mysteries, the modern discipline of science eventually emerged. I want to tell you what his bio is like. It's just extraordinary. Steven Weinberg is a theoretical physicist and winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics, the National Medal of Science, the Lewis Thomas Prize for Scientist as a Poet, and numerous honorary degrees and other awards. He also holds the Josie Regental Chair in Science at the University of Austin at Texas. So, Stephen, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning. It's the University of Texas at Austin, by the way.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you. Good morning. How are you, sir?
Just fine. You?
Yeah, great. Beautiful morning here in Park City. We wanted to ask you first why you decided to write this book.
I had been teaching a course in the history of science here at the University of Texas for some on and off for a decade, and I found in the course of teaching it that I was learning that the history of science was rather different from anything that I had thought. I had tended to think, as I think most people do, that we share common goals with the scientists of the past, that we all want to put together a coherent system of nature. What I learned, to my surprise, is how differently the great figures of the past thought about these things. They didn't understand the fact that the theories of nature that work are not theories that have anything to do with purpose, with human purpose. There's a complete divorce between human values and the laws of nature. They didn't understand the relation of science and mathematics. That's a complicated story, but the religion was all mixed up with it. We have now a clearer idea that we formulate assumptions about nature in the form of general principles, usually, at least in the physical sciences, formulated mathematically, that we test them experimentally. We keep finding errors, keep refining our theories. One big difference between science today and the past is that we've given up the idea of certainty, that all of our theories are just approximations to some better future theory.
Right.
None of our assumptions are certain. The Greeks, in particular, were fascinated by the example of mathematics, where you really do derive certain conclusions from unquestioned hypotheses, and they didn't realize that science had to be very different from that.
Right. And where would we be without the rebels, without the pillars of upheaval? When I think about Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Newton, actually, why don't you pick one of the pillars and tell us about them? Just pick one.
Oh, well, Newton is clearly the greatest figure. The scientific revolution of the 16th and 17th centuries reached its climax with Newton. But he was not a modern scientist. Some of his ideas were all mixed up with religion. For example, he thought that we'll never be able to understand in impersonal scientific terms why the sun and the stars shine, as compared with the planets, which have no light of their own. And only divine intervention could explain that. Well, of course, no, now that's not true, that the stars, including our sun, shine because there are nuclear reactions in their core, which produce the heat that at the surface produces light, comes to us across space. It's not that Newton was wrong so much, it's not so much that Newton didn't know why the stars shine. There's no way he could have known. I wouldn't call that a scientific failing. It's that he was so quick to introduce a divine intervention as an explanation for something which he simply didn't understand.
Hmm. So what you're saying is some of these scientists, like Newton, would defer to the bigger picture, to religion and maybe other types of more holistic views of the world when they couldn't explain through science. And was that pervasive, not just in the 16th and 17th century, but through many other times?
I'm glad you used the word holistic, because that's exactly the right word to use in this context. There's a yearning for a comprehensive understanding, which includes not only the physical world, why the stars shine, why the planets go the way they do, but also includes things like human morality, life after death, the whole picture. And even in the 20th century, a great physicist like Erwin Schrödinger, who in a book called Nature and the Greeks, praised the Greeks because they were searching for a holistic view of the world, a world in which there wasn't a sharp gap between science and, say, human morality. I think Schrödinger was wrong. I think he was right about the Greeks, but he was wrong to wish we were like them. One of the great discoveries of science has been that there are much-needed gaps, that we have to draw a distinction between things we can learn about by studying the world objectively and things that just come up out of our own feelings, like human morality. It's one of the biggest differences between science now and the science of the past. The Plato criticized an astronomer, Anaxagoras, very early astronomer, because Anaxagoras studied the motions of the planets in purely objective terms, without questioning which way would be better for them to move. Well, we've learned not to think in terms of purpose.
Uh-huh.
The universe, as we learn about it, doesn't seem to have any purpose. It just is the way it is.
So as a physicist who became fascinated by history, and as you say in your book, you think the best way to learn about something is to teach, which is so true, and great that you could teach at a great university and really learn the subject. But did it drive you a little bit crazy when you found that science was more like philosophy in some regards, you know, and that juxtaposed against how science is today?
Well, I wouldn't call it it drove me crazy. It was very interesting to learn about. I mean, you mentioned philosophy, that, Aristotle had strong philosophical doctrines about the way things can move, the way things can operate. And as a result, he, building on work of predecessors, he had a theory of the solar system that the planets are carried on spheres, all with the center of these spheres all being the same as the center of the Earth. That theory didn't work very well as compared with what you actually observe in the sky. Later Greeks, in particular Ptolemy, developed the theory of epicycles that really did work. And you might think, well, that would be the end of the story, that Ptolemy's theory would supplant Aristotle's. Not at all. Aristotle's theory went on to be the popular theory among philosophers, and also physicians, by the way, whereas Ptolemy's theory, which really worked for reasons we understand now, it wasn't just an accident, Ptolemy's theory was really much more of interest only to professional astronomers who had to make accurate predictions of where planets would be seen in the sky at any given date and time. You would think that science, represented by Ptolemy, observation, mathematical analysis, would have conquered philosophy, represented by Aristotle, almost immediately, but not at all. It just, argument between the two views of the solar system went on for 1,500 years until they were both supplanted by Copernicus.
Stephen, I'm curious, in the early years of science, did algebra and geometry exist, and was it applied to astronomy, or did astronomy drive the invention of algebra and geometry?
Interesting question. Algebra, as we know it now, didn't exist at all in the ancient world. That is the kind of thing you do when you solve a problem. John is 10 years older than Mary, but Mary is only half as old as John. How old are they both? That kind of question we solve today by giving symbols for the age of John and the age of Mary, writing down what you know in equations and then solving the equations. That process, which is the essence of algebra, wasn't really known until modern times. There's a book by an Arab savant of the, I think it's the 8th century, maybe the 9th century, Al-Khwarizmi, in which the title of his book uses the Arab word al-jabr, and for that reason, when algebra was developed, it was given that name, but there really wasn't any algebra. We know it now in Al-Khwarizmi's book. What the Greeks did develop to a very high degree was geometry, and they thought geometrically. In fact, they didn't even think arithmetically. It was really the Babylonians who introduced arithmetic into science, but the Greeks, as you suggested, by studying the heavens, found that they needed a more and more powerful comprehension of both geometry and arithmetic, not yet algebra.
Right.
And unfortunately, they didn't have trigonometry, which would have been tremendously helpful to them. And they were able to do wonderful things just with algebra, just with arithmetic and geometry. They were able to do things like estimate the sizes and distances of the sun and the moon and the size of the earth based on observations which weren't very good, so they didn't get very good answers. But their mathematics was impeccable. They did the calculations correctly. It's just a pity that they weren't able to make very accurate measurements.
Right. If you are just joining us, we are speaking with Steven Weinberg, who has written a fascinating book to explain the world, The Discovery of Modern Science. Steven is a theoretical physicist and the winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics. I also wanted to mention, speaking of math, that in your book, which is fascinating, you have technical notes in the back, and you have a number of equations and going through a lot of these theories. So it's interesting. It's the math isn't too hard. Some of it's pretty hard. But
bless you for saying that.
Yeah. So.
Wait, I think it's hard.
You be quiet.
And I also wanted to mention that the Greeks. I mean, it's so much easier to understand something that you can see. It's so much more difficult to not be able to understand what you can't see. But to have the celestial bodies in front of you, the sun, the moon, these planets, the stars. It was this laboratory, and I can, you can almost imagine, especially after reading your chapters on this, that the passion that they had for trying to understand what was going on, the wonder, the sense of wonder they had. And I'm curious, have we lost our sense of wonder? Do people look up into the sky anymore?
Well, we've lost a night sky, that's for sure. I don't know about Park City. You may have kept a dark sky there, but certainly where I live in Austin, Texas, the sky is much too lit up by the city lights to see very much of anything. You can see Mars when it's high in the sky and identify it, and occasionally in the winter you can see constellations like Orion, but you never see the Milky Way, for example, in the sky here. It must have been much more exciting in ancient times to look up at the sky when there were no city lights and almost everyone was asleep after dark, and look up at the sky and see, well, what Ptolemy called the mast-wielding circles of the heavens. Ptolemy wrote about his joy in studying the stars. I think people who are not professional astronomers have lost that, I think, because you don't see much these days when you look at the sky. I visited friends on a ranch in West Texas a few years ago, and after dinner we went out and sat on lawn chairs and looked up at the sky, and I couldn't believe how exciting it was. You could see the Milky Way and a lot of details in the Milky Way, and you could even see satellites going over every once in a while. Of course, the ancients didn't see that. It's interesting, though, that you see again and again in their writings that they thought the heavens were mysterious, and we really shouldn't expect to understand what's going on in the heavens. For example, the apparent motions of the planets against the background of stars. We really should try to understand what's here on Earth, but the heavens are beyond us. And in fact, just the opposite was true. Because in ancient times, just as now, the planets move in simple ways under the influence of a single force, the force of gravitation. The planets move in much smoother and more predictable ways than things here on the surface of the Earth. And so we began to understand the laws of nature much quicker by understanding the motion of the planets in particular than by studying things on the surface of the Earth, like tides, for example, which were incredibly complicated. And in fact, modern science was born in the understanding of the solar system, starting with Copernicus and reaching a climax with Newton. Even though for more than 1,000 years, savants had been saying, well, we can expect to understand what we have on Earth, but the heavens are beyond us. There's a lovely statement quoted in my book to that effect by Moses Maimonides, who was explaining in his Guide to the Perplexed to a perplexed young man that the theory of Aristotle, which is clearly correct philosophically, of the solar system, doesn't seem to fit observations. And he threw up his hands and said, well, what can you expect? You can't expect to understand the heavens. And that's just what we understand first.
Right. I wonder if John is somehow asking about that sense of wonderment as being, you know, back then there was a bigger sense of wonderment, perhaps, and we would just, as he said, as you said, throw up the hands and leave it to wonderment instead of, I don't know, and I wonder if the explanation, the scientific explanation with modern science somehow, I don't know if you were asking this, John, somehow kills our sense of wonderment.
Oh, no, I see what you, yes, that's an interesting question. To some extent, it does. It's not only science, but just geographical exploration. When 500 years ago, well, maybe I should say 600 years ago, when the exploration of the Earth had just barely begun, the Earth seemed filled with wonderful things. People drew maps that showed unicorns and people with their with the heads of dogs, and the world seemed incredibly mysterious and wonderful. Well, now we've mapped every square foot of it, or at least photographed every square foot, except what's under the oceans. And Earth doesn't seem so wonderful anymore. I mean, it's a nice place to live, but it's not mysterious. On the other hand, as we go along in this process of, we find things that are mysterious. Right now, we've discovered that 5/6 of the matter of the universe is some kind of particle that has never been observed in any of our laboratories. We call it dark matter. That's pretty mysterious. We've learned that that's only a small part of the energy in the universe. The energy in the universe that creates the gravitational field that affects the way galaxies are rushing away from each other is produced by something called dark energy, which we don't understand at all. That's the way it is. You learn more and more. Things that were mysterious become familiar, but new mysteries open up. There's an interesting question whether this will go on forever. Whether as we learn more and more about what already concerns us, we will always find more and more things to puzzle us. I don't know. Maybe we'll reach a final theory. I've written another book about that called Dreams of a Final Theory, which speculates about what kind of final theory there might be and what we'll feel like when we discover it. But as I make clear in that book, we don't know. We don't even know that we're smart enough
right.
to understand.
Can we comprehend
the final theory?
That?
I mean, just biologically, that we've got enough juice in our brains so that the fundamental theory can be understood by human beings. We're guessing it can. Otherwise, we'd be pretty sad.
I think the example you had in the book. The example you had in the book was really good, which is it's like trying to understand mathematically consciousness, and there are some things that we may not ever be able to understand.
Well, yeah, I picked on consciousness. Of course, this is not an original thought of mine. The philosophers have struggled with this now for decades. it is very hard, maybe able to understand consciousness in terms of knowing what activities in the physical brain correspond to to the activity of the consciousness, but to describe conscious feelings in impersonal physical terms, it's hard to see how we'll ever be able to do that. I mean, for example, how will you and I ever be able to compare the feelings we get when we look at the color red? Philosophers call this the problem of the qualia. I don't know where that word comes from, but we can certainly hope to map in the brain the electric currents that are produced when we look at red. But how do I know your feelings about that, your conscious feelings, are the same as mine? It seems an unbridgeable gap between the consciousness and the rest of science. And yet, you know, it's the thing about which, in a sense, we know the most, because we all have a consciousness, and we all live with it every moment of our lives, and yet it seems totally mysterious from the point of view of objective science.
Stephen, unfortunately, we have run out of time. Lynn and I would love to keep talking with you. And by the way, my favorite color is red. Stephen has written a fascinating book, To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science. We want to thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it. And remember, you don't have to read the technical notes.
That's right.
Oh, thank you. I feel so much better. Thank you, Professor Weinberg.
Nice talking to you.
Okay.
Have a good day.
When we return, we'll have a conversation with Michael Tennyson, author of The Next Species, The Future of Evolution and the Aftermath of Man. Are we headed for a sixth mass extinction? Well, stay tuned. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. I'm John Wells.
I'm Peggy Ijams.
Join us Friday at 9 a.m. on The Morning Mix.
We'll highlight local musicians, of course, take a look at weekend events, and give you our take on stuff and junk in the news.
That's Friday at 9 a.m. on The Morning Mix, brought to you by Utah Olympic Park, Squatters and Wasatch Brew Pub, New Park Terrace, and Crandall Capital.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, we were just speaking with Professor Steven Weinberg, his book, To Explain the World. Very interesting conversation. Our next guest is Michael Tennyson. He's the author of the book, The Next Species, The Future of Evolution in the Aftermath of Man. Now, there have been five mass extinctions in the last 600 million years, including the Cretaceous extinction, during which an asteroid knocked out the dinosaurs. That's the one we all know most about. Though these events were initially destructive, they were also prime movers of evolutionary change in nature. And we can see some of the warning signs of another extinction event coming as our oceans lose both fish and oxygen. In The Next Species, Michael Tennyson questions what life might be like if a sixth mass extinction were to happen. Michael, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you very much, then, John.
Nice to have you.
Good to be here.
Our last guest, Steven Weinberg, was talking about how, in early science, he goes through the history of science and how early science was relatively clouded by religion in a lot of ways. And now maybe science is clouded by politics in a lot of ways. I want to get that question out of the way right in the beginning here with a sixth extinction. What are your comments about the political, whatever political comments you've been getting since you wrote your book?
Well, the political aspect is essentially the population aspect. 200 years ago, in 1800, we had 1 billion people on Earth, and now we have 7 billion. By the mid-century, we're talking about 9 billion. By the end of the century, it could be 10 or 11 billion. And I really believe that this is the most important problem we have right now ongoing that affects the biodiversity of life on Earth. It affects all the plants and animals. And it's just a matter of, like, you know, it's, population is even more controversial than climate change. You don't really talk about climate change than population, and we really have to address population. Or, you know, we're climbing a populist extreme. It's not really noted in our last history, in our history of life of man on Earth. The population is really surging like this. Yorgi Ghosh at the University of Moscow did a studies with this, in which he put microbes in test tubes with oatmeal and water, watched them go, and what happens is there's a gradual increase in population over a while, and then all of a sudden, big, huge shoot up, you know, in population. But then it reaches the point where population, where it runs, where the basically the microbes run out of nutrients, and then there's this just big crash, and that's kind of what we're at. We're heading up the ladder, and we need to pull back the reins.
So, you know, 50 years ago, scientists may have predicted the carrying capacity of Earth as being X number, and fast forward 50 years, I'm sure there's still a... Well, I mean, how has that evolved? I mean, are some scientists now saying we will learn to adapt? And others are saying, no way, the carrying capacity of Earth is much less, much fewer people than we thought.
I'm hearing more of the second side. The carrying capacity of Earth is less than we previously thought. And, you know, I talked about population growth from 1800 to present, but really the last 50 years is where most of that population growth, the lion's share of the population growth happened. So we're looking at 50 years where we've just exploded. We're like a virus. It's taken over the world. And it has to be done. It's an important thing. And the carrying capacity of the Earth is essentially measured in our food consumption. The Green Revolution that showed where scientists developed short stocks of wheat and corn and even rice that were able to handle all our added fertilizers and increased methods of irrigation gave us an opportunity to keep growing. But now we're getting to a point where there's no big solution like the Green Revolution. There's no easy. Nothing easy. I visited the Rothamsted Institute in north of London, and they had a bunch of different really complex experiments going on just to get another 10% out of crops. And these were like 20-year goals. And you get there, and then what do? You yell, yay, we finally made it. and you have another 10 years to accomplish the same again. And scientists talk about how we've already used 40% of the available croplands of land on Earth for crops. In the future, we're going to have to go to 60% used, and we've already used the best stuff. We've already got the best ground. Now we have to go to less than best ground. So it's a real crisis.
Michael, the Permian.
Okay, John.
The Permian mass extinction right before the Jurassic was the most poisonous, lethal of all the mass extinctions,
right,
according to your book. But something really interesting comes out of that extinction. Prior to it, only 30% of plants and animals were tolerant of massive doses of CO2. And
right,
after the extinction, 90%. Is it safe to say that if it weren't for mass extinctions, we would not be here?
It's possible, it really is. If it wasn't for the comet falling from the sky, mammals may not have exploded as they did. We were essentially running around. We were like, and I'll get back to your Permian extinction. I mean, that's a very important extinction. That was 95% of all life on in the ocean, and over 70% of life on Earth. But the Permian extinction, what it did, we were like essentially little rats running around the surface of the land and trying to stay away from the dinosaurs. And it was only when the dinosaurs were eradicated, when they went extinct, that we really were able to get up and move and start growing. We grew exponentially after that.
You're talking about humans.
Right. We're talking about mammals.
Mammals, because humans have only been around for, what?
Right, 200,000 years.
Yeah, and that was 65 That was 65 million years ago.
Mammals.
Also, I wanted to mention, speaking of that extinction, that that you describe, I think it was China or Japan, that you went out and you found the line in the soil in the rock between the Permian period and the Jurassic period, which was above that line, and it was interesting. You're able to ascertain that there was 95% of species that were made extinct because there were a bunch of fossils below the line, and there weren't many fossils above the line. That's
right,
and that's how you know that there was a mass extinction, and that's how you know the percentage.
Well, that's the line. You know, the scientists have always been looking for the line where there's the, you know, they look in these layers of soil on Earth, and they look for chemical or geochemical evidence of change, radical change, and finding these mass extinction events. That's actually work from Sam Bowring, a geologist at MIT, and he went out there with Chinese counterparts and found this line, and it is, and they can see that in the fossils. They can see fossils of life, forest, and then right after they can see the huge loss of fossils, huge loss of animals that existed on Earth at the time, and that's, you know, they spent a lot of time doing that. That's Sam Bowring's summary.
So to paint a clear picture of how these extinctions go, these mass extinctions, I remember when we spoke to Elizabeth Colbert about her book, The Sixth Extinction, and she said, hey, folks, don't, you know, it's not doomsday. I mean, this sixth extinction is happening now, and it's gradual. So the two extinctions you've talked about so far were very... what was the word you used? They were very sudden and very urgent and disastrous. But talk about some of the other extinctions and how it relates to this extinction.
Well, the Permian extinction and the Cretaceous extinction actually weren't all that sudden. The Permian extinction, it's over a period of 10 million years that this happened. And the Cretaceous extinction, even though scientists talk about the asteroid falling out of the sky, there was what they call the Deccan Traps. These are large volcanic activity that occurred in India at the time that was actually pouring CO2 into the atmosphere, as well as the CO2 and the other and the volcanic dust that was added to the atmosphere when the meteor struck. So scientists look at these things as actually, geologically, they're rapid. 10 million years or a million years is a little point on the scale when you're talking about geological evidence. But from a human perspective, I mean, that's a long time. That's longer than we've been on Earth.
That's right, especially considering that you say, and some scientists say, that the next extinction may occur even less time than you say. That's the 300 years.
Right, 1,200, which is what Anthony Bernofsky predicted in a paper out of the University of California at Berkeley. But that's if we start seeing endangered species disappear.
Yes.
So there is that one caveat, and which is happening as we speak. But we're holding a lot of species back from the precipice through some pretty heroic efforts. But it's like with the California condor. I mean, how long is it going to be with us in 1,000 years? Probably not.
Right. Well, you talk about some of the warning signs of this extinction, and they're really rampant around us. If we just open our eyes, we see them. But you go through in quite some detail. Let's start with this imbalance between the oxygen and nitrogen in our water and how that affects marine life.
Right. The balance of nitrogen, nitrogen is affecting, we're getting some effects of nitrogen in the air and on land. And what we're really seeing is in our waters is, at least when you're talking about oceanic waters, we're talking about CO2 and acidification. And that's the basic problem. That's one of the greatest problems we have here is after this, we used to think of the ocean as being a great place to suck up our excess CO2, our excess carbon dioxide. I remember there was even plans to spread iron from large boats into the ocean just to kind of speed up that suck up of the oxygen. Until they find out, the ocean is sucking up oxygen, but it's turning it into carbonic acid. And what that is doing is that's destroying shelled animals. It's destroying the ability of crustaceans to form shells. Mm. It's destroying the ability of coral to form reefs. It's destroying the ability of many animals, and some of them are just small little shrimps and things like that in the Arctic Ocean that are really important to whales. And so that's the dominant thing that's happening on Earth is the suck up of CO2 into the ocean, and nitrogen and phosphorus come to play more on inland lakes and rivers and such. Phosphorus being a really important polluter, and nitrogen actually having more effects on the ocean at when it ends up in the seas at the mouths of the ocean, at the mouth of rivers.
Michael, if we could take a moment and go way, way back in history and talk about the beginning of life. When I was in high school, we were taught that there was this primordial soup, and it was hydrogen, methane, and might have been some ammonia, might have been a ham bone, maybe some split peas. There was a lot in this soup, but that it was recreated when scientists zapped it with electricity, kind of like Frankenstein. Brought to life these molecules and they appeared and life began. But that's not the consensus of scientists today. What's the current thinking on how life began?
Well, Stanley Miller I think he was the University of Chicago was the one that did this primordial soup experiment. And that was actually, I think it made the cover of Time magazine. They finally discovered how it happened. But scientists increasingly now believe that Stanley actually zapped it with electricity in the end, and that was the idea that was the creator of life. And what they believe that that's not going to work any better than shocking a corpse with electricity. And so what they're really looking now to is they're looking to the deep ocean, and they did some work where they did to put down deep ocean vehicles. Along the trench in the Atlantic Ocean that shows
oh the thermal vents
it's all the thermal vents and then but they thought that this was a little too acidic to actually create this effect. And Stanley Miller or actually Michael Russell at JPL, he's gone down there and find further from the ridge, the ocean ridge, where the hot water comes, other thermal vents that are a little bit cooler and a little bit less acidic. And he believes this is called them the white smokers. We call the Atlantic Trench. We call the smokers there black smokers.
Oh, right.
So these,
right.
So these are the white smokers.
Right.
So that's the current best best held theory I've got. although it's not proven yet.
So what's interesting, Michael, is that when you think about life, you think about our extraordinary sun that's providing these photons of light, this heat that warms this planet. But down in those thermal vents and sunlight for photosynthesis and those sorts of things, down in those thermal vents, there's no light. It's very cold, except when you get to the thermal vent, and sun does not play a direct part.
And they actually believe that sulfur emitting from these events are the primary driver of life. And apparently there are some fairly large creatures, although they're deep ocean creatures down in those vicinities, yeah. It's a whole different chemistry, which is an interesting thing. It's not the way chemistry... It's not the way life exists on Earth today. It's a different form of life, but it's protected from UV radiation, and it's also protected from our use of it. So this is one of the reasons that they still exist today. Although there's even some efforts to go down and start knocking over some of these things just because they might be full of precious minerals.
Right. Well, how to exist. We've jumped around a lot in this conversation. We're just about out of time. But Michael, my favorite part of your book is, you know, it kind of relates back to the actual title, The Next Species. Now, there have been 25 human species, you say, but right now there's just one. There's just us. But you also say, why not another? And one that can adapt if there is the sixth extinction. So with a minute left, can you kind of explain that?
Well, there's a number of species that there's been 25 species on Earth. There's no reason we couldn't have another. 50,000 years ago, we had three or four on Earth. Now we only have one. Okay, one of the possible efforts would be just to genetic manipulation. If we start using genetic manipulation, we could create a super race that didn't want to have anything to do with the other race. That's one way we could have other species. I talked to a fellow at Nick Bostrom at Oxford University. He thinks that we'll get to a point where people, when they get close to death, want to upload their minds into a computer so they can continue to live on either in a virtual world or a robot. That's one other option. And there's also artificial intelligence. I mean, this could actually be, if we give the artificial intelligence the ability to decrease itself, it could actually get to the point where it outthinks us and starts to think of us maybe somewhat useless. And so there's a variety of different things that could happen in the future. One of them is being, if we went to Mars, if we established a colony on Mars, that would be a great environment for trying to establish another species, just because there's a heavy UV radiation, lack of oxygen, and also one-third the gravity we have on Earth. And when the Russian cosmonauts went up into the space station, they'd come back and their whole bodies would be rearranged after they spent time in space, and that their legs would be like bird legs, and all the weight would just kind of shift up to the top side of the body. So all these influences could easily create another species, and according to Darwin, you know, something adapts better than us, and it tends to outcompete us and eliminate us.
That's right. The book is The Next Species, A Future of Evolution in the Aftermath of Man. And Michael Tennyson, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. And thanks, John.
Thanks. And you've been listening to KPCW Park City. Want to thank our sponsors, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. It's time for news. Again, it's KPCW Park City. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.